Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us for the conversation on this Aloha Friday, March 28th. Today we're broadcasting live from the island of Hawaii at the Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden in South Kona. Today we're talking about creatures great and small, and we are broadcasting segments from a live taping of the show at the Kahilu Theater in Waimea. We hear from former state veterinarian and author Dr. Billy Bergen about one of the oldest and largest ranches in Hawaii. We also talk to his son, Dr. Brady Bergen, who is credited with helping to manage our feral donkey problem dating back to a decade and a half ago. We hear from the community about issues with feral animals and introduce you to a Hawaii Island honey creeper in this week's Manu Minute. We wrap with Patrick Hart. His newest idea helps us learn and care for our native birds. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We were fortunate to be in Waimea last Friday, where we taped in front of a live audience at the Kahilu Theater. It was a special HPR event featuring The Conversation and Kanakapila Sunday. It's where we were able to chat with Dr. Billy Bergen. He's the author of a number of books, including the fourth and last volume of Loyal to the Land, a legendary Parker Ranch. The series documents the history of Parker Ranch, around which the town of Waimea was built and where he worked as a veterinarian. Here's our conversation with Dr. Bergen.
I like the hat. Thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. I mean, my first job was at a horse ranch when I was 14 years old, so to be able to talk about the history of Parker Ranch, you know, one of the oldest and largest ranches in the country, is a real treat for me. But maybe if you can just share with our audience why you thought it was so important to get these stories down, loyal to the land.
Thank you. I am honored, absolutely overwhelmed with humility, just to simply come and sit before you and share. But if you take the title, Loyal to the Land, that's out of a Hawaiian love song, and I explain in the book, I'm not sure if it was Kapi'olani, or who, in one of her songs, refers to Aloha Mahope, look to the back, and appreciate those that came before you. So when I sat down for my first interview with Richard Smart, I can't tell you how nervous I was. First of all, by his sheer appearance of good looks, skin that's bronze, and a voice that just causes you to want to just sit and listen to just common conversation. But Richard and I spoke very briefly. And of course, he was a very family man. He asked about Pat and asked about the children and what they were doing and what their names were. And he would remember those names at the Christmas party the following year. But as we were kind of wrapping up our interview, which wasn't long, he did say, I'd like to share with you a short piece of advice. And he said, Hawaiians call this to sort of an edict, olelo pa'a, speak firmly and absolutely. And his words were, every calf counts. And because of that inspiration from him, I made sure that at the end of each year, I wrote a very comprehensive animal health report that measured 48 different measures of improvement in animal health, especially cattle health. And I want to compliment Paula DeSilva and Betty Spence, who is so sharp with the computer, that they had that thing in such a way that they could just press a button and give me a daily report. Because agriculture is like any other commodity. It's measured in numbers. And the greater your survival, especially through marketing, the greater your return on the investment. So I set out to do that. And every year, thanks to a wonderful secretary of Richard Smart named Kiyomi Yoshimatsu, who's probably the closest and dearest friend Richard ever had, would do the report for me. I'd had hand write it, just like my darling wife takes my handwriting and produces those seven books. Every single word in there was written on a yellow legal tablet and turned over to her. And she would, of course, correct the diction and spelling and leave out the profanity and things like that. So I certainly want to honor my wife for the help in doing that. So let's get back to why I wrote the book. I came to Park Ranch on July 1st of 1970, and I left on July 1st of 1995. And I had written 25 comprehensive reports. And we were on a stage like this when Frank Hess, who was the sort of the ranch, he coordinated everything. And a wonderful former serviceman that conducted his mission in a very military and regimented fashion. Everybody knew their job and where they were placed and what to do. And on that day, he called me to the stage, the manager did, and I think at that time it was Charlie Kimura. And he handed me what appeared to be a Bible, and it was about 4 inches thick, and it was the hardbound copies of each of my annual reports. And I was impressed with that. You know, I don't think I kept all the copies myself. And I appreciated that. It was very meaningful. The closing chapter of each of those reports, I would pick out an employee that I found shined above all. And somebody, it wouldn't be necessarily a very well-known or popular guy. It was just that he conducted his mission in such a worthy fashion that was so in the best interest of the cattle and horses and calves that I wanted to thank them. Some of them were saddened when we lost Elmer Lim Sr. I dedicated that report to Elmer because I was there when he brought down a triple-decker trailer loaded with calves headed for Canada. And that came from Waikiki elevation right down to the wharf at Kauai High. And he stepped off the truck and laid down, and Elmer died right there. And of course, Elmer's name is known in music as well, but the whole family are very honorable people that helped preserve Hawaiiana by their sheer professional entertainment. Well, anyhow, to have this bound copy like a Bible, Pat and I have to go on a cruise to write, partly because I need to be uninterrupted. I love the outdoors. If someone calls and has a need for me to go, I'm so tickled to death to go, because I want to be outside. And you get on a ship, you can step outside, you're going to step off the ship.
Makes you focus.
So I really always, Pat and I must have made about 35 or 40 cruises, and they were all for the purpose of writing.
Wow. Well, I was excited to, you know, I called you because I saw an article about how we had anthrax in our cattle and dairy cows on Oahu and Kauai and Maui, and but I didn't read about the Big Island, and so I called you up, and I'm like, did we have anthrax here? Because that was like more than 100 years ago.
And there's no known diagnosis of anthrax. When you called me and mentioned Kauai, I was shocked. Right after our call, I called Dr. Jason Moniz, who's retired state veterinarian, extremely knowledgeable guy. And I asked him about it, and he said, yeah, it's been kept reasonably confined to that particular incident. You can alarm people with the term anthrax. Remember when they had to scare people, open an envelope, and white dust would come out, and that would be the spores of Bacillus anthracis that causes the disease, highly fatal and a very, very undignified and painful ending to someone's life. And I was shocked to hear that. And I asked Jason, I mean, what do you do? You can't dig up a whole golf course and try and find the organism. And the more you dig it up, the more dust you would create, and it becomes airborne.
Right,
so your poor construction workers are exposed. So he said, no, that's a real challenge. He didn't elaborate on how they were going to go about it, but he agreed with the sensitivity of it. Well, now to finish your answer your question, I'm Irish, so we take a long time to explain. But what it really amounts to is I took that compendium of 25 annual reports, something to read on the trip. Well, if you read your own writing, it's like kissing your sister. There's no action, you know. So I took it along, and I just kind of thumbed through it. And there would be outbreaks, or there would be severe accidents and stuff, and I'd always stop on that and catch up on it, because it was exciting and noteworthy. But where I always ended before I closed that chapter was my last chapter, dedicated to Suoyo Yamasaki. Suoyo was a Japanese man that ran the warehouse. He controlled the biologicals and pharmaceuticals that are issued to the cowboys as they're going to go out and brand maybe 1,500 head of cattle. He never had to return for more medicine. He always had the dosage correct. And he was very, very strict about refrigeration, which is how you keep biologicals active. And I appreciated Yama so much for his work. And when I got through that trip and I was mulling it over on the flight back home, I said, man, you know, you just take those 25 biological essays of those people. Those are remarkable people. And they were Richard Smart's people. Richard loved his people, loved his employees.
And I think, you know, when I was looking at this most recent book, you know, yeah, you have the history, you have the politics, you know, behind it, but you have the people,
yeah.
The cowboys, the families yeah. that really were the heart of Parker Ranch.
Yeah. Let me point out a couple of families that are noteworthy. In my first book, I wrote five foundation families. There were two Lindsay brothers. There was a Bell. There was a Stevens. And when I would write a foundation family, if they were from a prefect in Japan, I would go to Japan. I traveled a lot to write. New Zealand. How did those natives prepare the vessel with food and make this long, and the animals take this long sojourn to find the Hawaiian Islands? So I travel a lot to different countries. And of course, I needed references. I needed information to be able to substantiate what I believed I was reading was this history. I wanted to see for myself. Most fortunately, Maori people wrote a lot, which, and Hawaiians were spoken word. Whereas it was so easy in New Zealand to find a good bookstore and find wonderful texts, hardbound texts on certain things, like the pig and the pig coming here. That was a magical trip for the fact that, number one, pigs cannot stand direct sunlight. They cannot stand heat well. They're not built for it. They don't sweat. They don't expel heat, body heat. They die. Number one, you don't want pigs to get near salt or salt water. Without, on their own volition, they can go in the shore and go fishing themselves and go dig around for shells. But you can't leave the water resource to be salt water, because this intoxicates them and kills them. So how did they prepare vessels of water to make this trip? And on that, the early travelers that reached here, they came with the pig, the dog, chicken and the rat. And the dog, of course, was an edible companion. And I don't mean that to be funny. It's just a matter of fact. But in this New Zealand library, I bought the book because it was fascinating. It was a Tahitian or Maori prince that wrote it. And he had a chapter purely on the pig. Well, I'm a veterinarian. You talk about animals, I want to know more about it. And I read it. And the theme of his chapter was, the pig is our heart. And he even converted that to almost like Hawaii, where you have a baby luau at the baby's first year. And then when they pau high school or maybe pau college or get married or have their first baby. And I figured up, as a rule, in my lifetime, among friends of mine, they would celebrate six times in their life using a pig to celebrate in honor of that child or that achievement. And I think that's a remarkable relationship of man to animal and appreciation for the animal, almost in a spiritual way.
Yeah, I never thought about it that
yeah.
way. That is interesting. And you know, today we have a problem with feral pigs and feral goats, and we had one with feral donkeys, which, you know, your son, Dr. Brady Bergen,
yeah.
you know, single-handedly, you know, with help from the community, rounded them up, but he sterilized those of female donkeys and was able to knock the population down. And in reading some of the history from the College of Tropical Agriculture, mm-hmm. wonderful records about how the horses, when they first came here, after many years, became a nuisance, you know? And so it's interesting that what we're dealing with today with the wild animals.
You bring up a point that's very close to me. Since my youth, I've ridden on horseback the shoulders of the three major mountain ranges. And the great beauty of Hawaii is from up on high looking down. And when I returned to some of those campsites, and I look at my surroundings, that the oversupply of feral animals have taken away a lot of Hawaii's beauty, as well as our good health. And I'm very, very saddened to take my trip to Hilo. Most of my youth was spent in the Humula area. And to see those beautiful rolling hills, like velvet, eaten down to dirt. And you'll see sheep swarm across back and forth, depending on the traffic and stuff. I hope in my lifetime I see the return of especially DLNR to begin to take that thing seriously, as Brady did. Nobody wants to touch it. You got to be really careful in how you want to depopulate pigs, because, like I said, to the Hawaiian people, a pig is like they said in Tahiti, New Zealand, he said, the pig is our heart. And we celebrate chapters of our lives by consuming the pork. And together with, if you take the oversupply of wild goats, they swarm. It's almost like a flowing of lava, the way they move en masse, and thousands of them go up the saddle road to go to Hilo. Just keep an eye on it. They look like little ants, and pretty soon the lance are in line, and pretty soon the line gets wider and wider and wider, and they just move over the hills looking for feed or water. So it's a tough one.
Yeah, so we've got to deal with this issue now and for the future.
Yes.
And, you know, Parker Ranch is moving into, you know, another era. I mean, we've been dealing with the wildfires and climate change. And, you know, we have Mike Akane taking over, mm-hmm. you know, lots of hope there coming from the Hawaii Community Foundation and Kamehameha Schools. And in your book, you talk about the politics of Parker Ranch and the community, and you make parallels with Kamehameha Schools and mm-hmm. broken trust and what good came out of that. What do you see for the future for Parker Ranch?
You notice on the subtitle is an enduring legacy. Let me define that. I spent not just 25 years as a veterinarian on Parker Ranch. I worked at Kukulani Stables as a stable hand in 1958, before I left for Kansas State University for 10 years, state of Kansas. And did I ever want to come home quick. But at the end of the day, I really love the people of Kansas and in Kansas itself. It's flat as this state, and the wind doesn't blow, it whistles. The people are just super, very basic. Back to Parker Ranch. Now, we mentioned the legacy. Let me put it in a different, and you'll find it in my words. I make the statement that when you join Parker Ranch, when you come to Parker Ranch and either employ it or live on the ranch, something takes a hold of you. And over those 25 years and of course the years since then, occasionally people they leave the ranch involuntarily, they get canned. And those guys are friends of mine, and they had a mishap that caused it. And when I talk to them, I quote my own nephew, Chris Kawa, a day never goes by when I don't think of Parker Ranch. And that speaks to, I don't know, I guess Hawaiians would call that uhani pa'oli. Uhani would be a spirit, like the Holy Bible is. Uhane Himalaya, the Holy Spirit. that captures you, and you never really get over wanting to look at the hills and the sleeting rain and all of that, especially the people, remarkable people. Of those five foundations, families, I'm going to mention one, and that would be Stevens. And Captain Stevens arrived in Kauai High and was taken by a princess named Kili'iwahamana, one with a voice of wisdom. And Nina Kili'iwahamana is, I think, still producing music, beautiful singer. Well, the Stevens family got to be a big one. And they are very characteristic people. Stevens, I'm almost speaking from a genetic standpoint or DNA standpoint, they have put an imprint on their appearance, especially their eyes, that if I'm trying to do a book signing and there'll be a line of maybe 10 or 12 people, some of them holding a baby or some young couple, and I can look at them and I can pick out which one came down the road from Stevens just by their beautiful eyes. There were two prominent brothers, Charlie or Walter Stevens were brothers, and just by their sheer appearance, and especially to see them on a horseback, was a piece of art. They were so well groomed. Their Levi's were starched with a nice crease, always, always well groomed and well shaven. But boy, were they ever cattlemen and cowboys and horsemen. And I write a lot about Collie and Walter because they're so special. Now take that and multiply it times the 147 years of which, if you read the history of the Stevens people, invariably they held a high place in leadership of the ranch because it was prepotent. It's in them to pass on generationally your qualities. And that's true even of animals. A famous racing stallion has a high index of prepotency. When they have what is called a speed index, they measure all the colts. And you're talking about thousands and thousands of years, and they can predict by the speed index through the genetic line how that horse will perform on a 1 mile, on a quarter mile, or a half mile. It's really become that, and that's prepotency. That stallion was so prepotent. He passed down speed. Mm-hmm. You know, we can talk about man of war and horses like that. And I believe that happens in humans just as well. And yeah. My father was a medical doctor, so it was always good to share with him what I learned that day.
Well, you know, there's a line in this book with a picture of you and a horse, and it says, "The West is dead, my friend, but writers hold the seed, and what they sow will live and grow again to those who read." And I think it's just tremendous that, you know, you have put this history down on paper, mm-hmm. and you could share it, you know, with this community, with the state, mm-hmm. with the world, really, about the heart and soul yeah. of Parker Ranch and the legacy that they leave behind. Thank you, Wynn, again.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you, Kat.
Thank you. That was veterinarian and historian Dr. Billy Bergen, who we interviewed before a live audience at the Kahilu Theater. We'll be back with a segment that includes his son, Dr. Brady Bergen. You're listening to The Conversation, and we're broadcasting live from the Big Island this morning to discuss all things animal. We've seen feral animal populations boom across the state, from chickens and cats to pigs and goats to deer and sheep, and donkeys too. I first connected with Dr. Brady Bergen because of a crazy idea he was working on. The mission? Sterilize the population of wild donkeys in Waikoloa that were suffering because of drought conditions. The Kona Nightingales were going into town, and reports say drinking water from people's swimming pools because they were so thirsty.
We talked with him yesterday as he reflected back on that time in 2010. Dr. Bergen now resides in Minnesota and is part of the faculty at the University of Minnesota. He recalled the day when Big Island rancher Stan Botello stopped by his clinic and asked him to help the donkeys. That's how Dr. Brady Bergen, who doesn't believe in lethal eradication, started on his mission to sterilize the animals.
He approached me and said, hey, I was wondering if you can help me. I've got a really big problem down there in Waikoloa, and I don't know what to do with it. You know, so he explained a little bit, and I was like, God, you know, and he took me down there. He's like, you just got to come and see it, because he's like, you're not going to believe it. And when he took me down there, it was eye-opening. It wasn't until I could see what he was concerned about. You know, there was, and at the time, there was serious drought conditions, you know, and Waikoloa is already dry. You know, so Waikoloa in drought conditions is extremely dry. So there's limited grass, there's no water sources, and these donkeys were unhealthy. Like, some of them were, had significant injuries, you know, broke, they're hobbling around on broken legs. Some of them were skinny and emaciated. And, you know, as a rancher, that was hard for him to see. And he was helpless. He didn't have the resources to do anything with them. So he was reaching out for help. Anybody that could have any ideas, anybody that could help would be great. So when he took me down there and I saw it, I was shocked at how many there were, and how much their health was being impacted by the drought and everything. So it was pretty easy. I mean, as a veterinarian, you know, it's pretty easy to get involved in something like that, because by nature, that's what we do. You know, it's kind of in our blood, and we're trained to be there to help animals in need. And that was an easy decision for me. Plus, with the history and growing up there, and the donkeys being a part of the culture and everything. So it was really Stanley that got me on board with trying to help in some way. And at the time, I was like, oh my God, this is a big problem. I didn't know where to start. But around the same time, the Waikoloa community was kind of reaching out and looking for help too, because it was impacting the community as well. There was no, like, Stanley's water, like his water troughs for his cattle were the only water sources they had. But there was also the village, Waikoloa village, where the donkeys were encroaching. You know, it was vehicle hazard. It was a hazard for traffic, but it was also becoming a hazard within Waikoloa village. These donkeys were roaming through people's yards. They were getting onto the golf course, and you know, the golf course was like a haven. You know, it's a perfect environment for a donkey because the grass is lush. You know, they've got water sources, and then the sand traps are, you know, a natural source of salt for them. So it was becoming a problem for the community too. So the Waikoloa Community Association was already kind of looking out for ways to control the population a little bit and get some control on the ones that were, you know, they're getting into people's yards, they're chasing people's dogs.
What was the count at the time? Do you recall?
So, you know, thanks in part to the Humane Society of the United States that got on board, you know, with this project. And if it wasn't for them, you know, Humane Society of the United States, we wouldn't have never have been as successful as we were. But to answer your question, the way we were able to estimate the count, one, it was through Stanley's estimates, but Humane Society of the United States also funded helicopter tours. So we went up by helicopter and got kind of a rough estimate, you know, flew over the grazing territory. So at the time it was, we estimated about 600 head.
I just remember seeing those donkeys on the ridgeline, and it looked like a trail of ants. It was just really stunning.
Yeah, they're bigger animals, you know, so you think, you know, 600 head compared to, you know, some of the numbers of sheep and goats and pigs and things that we see now, it's 600 is not that much, but these are big animals, you know, so to see 600 of these donkeys roaming around down there was pretty eye-opening.
So you were able to sterilize the male donkeys, and you got the numbers then down to something more manageable.
Yeah, we got it down probably to about 50 head, and our goal was to get it down to 25, because Stanley felt he could manage a herd of 25 pretty easily with his cattle and everything that were on there, but I think we got it down to about 50, and that was as good as we could get, because the approach that we took was we're going to castrate the males and then rehome as many as we could. So it got kind of funny, because it was at the point where, you know, I felt my friends weren't answering my calls because they were afraid I was going to try to pawn a donkey off on them. But it was hard, because there's only so many people, so many ranchers, you know, the community, there's only so much that could be done to rehome them. And it was an incredible community support. You know, I look at the success of that project, I look at it as one big puzzle. You know, and there were a lot of pieces to that puzzle. I was one piece. Humane Society of the United States was a huge piece. The Waikoloa community was a big piece. So many of the ranches in the area stepped up and said, yeah, we can take some, you know, we can turn them out on our land. All of the people on the Big Island that adopted some, you know, all the way from our west side all the way to the east side. And so many people stepped up with fundraising. It was just such a big community effort. Another big piece of that puzzle was the Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue. And they were, at the time, they were based in California. And I think their headquarters is now in Texas. But they had gotten in touch with the founder of that operation. And even they were like, wow, this is a really big problem. But they went ahead and they adopted 120 donkeys from the Big Island. And thanks to the Humane Society of the United States, we were able to fly 120 donkeys to California for Peaceful Valley to take over their care and rehome them to their recipients there. That was a huge, huge undertaking, you know. But again, it takes money. You know, those things don't happen. It's hard without the funding. But I felt it was what I needed to do. That was my community service. You know, I'm predominantly an equine veterinarian. I always loved the donkeys. I loved them even more after that project. I learned so much about them, and their whole demeanor is, they're so underappreciated and misunderstood. They're just an incredibly intelligent species that are just fascinating to me. This overpopulation impacts everyone because overpopulation impacts the land, you know, and land is limited there. We got to take care of the land as best we can. We got to be good stewards of the land. And these feral populations of no fault of their own are hurting the land.
Hurting the land. That was Dr. Brady Bergen, who is now on the faculty at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. Years ago, he and his staff worked with the Humane Society of the United States to help reduce the number of feral donkeys on the west side of the Big Island. Bergen credits the efforts of the community, and in particular, Sam Botello and Sonny Keokeolani.
Support for HPR comes from Kahilu Theater in Waimea on Hawaii Island. Mana Music Quartet performs selections from their album Journey Through Hawaii, along with music of the Hawaiian Monarchy, April 6th. Tickets at kahilu.org.
After the Lahaina fires, rumors that FEMA would begin seizing land began surfacing on social media. So why was it so easy to believe these false rumors? We'll explore the historical context behind locals' fear of losing their land and homes yet again on Episode 5 of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. Tune in this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from HMSA, celebrating over 85 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation, where we are broadcasting live from the Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden in South Kona. We wanted to know how ferals and invasives are impacting life here. Lou Putzel is the executive director of the garden. The Conversation's Maddie Spender spoke with him this morning about the challenges that come with managing an ethnobotanical garden.
Just like all land around here, invasive species are one of our biggest challenges. If you just look at these clumps of trees up ahead of us, those trees are alahe'e, and those are a tree that creates these very dense and dark thickets. That's an endemic tree here. If you let it go, it'll spread and it will do its own job of keeping everything else out. Nothing else is going to grow under that dense thicket of alahe'e. By contrast, if you look over here in this bed that's got a lot of sunlight and very much in the open, we're constantly coming in here and having to weed this. This has a mixture of many different kinds of weeds, including Crassicephalum, which is not a terrible one, but you can eat it. But it's also got Spanish needle, which is an annoying plant because it covers you with little sticky seeds. And, you know, all these weeds are competing with this native collection. Sometimes you just have to get down on your hands and knees and you have to take care of them manually if you have the labor. If you don't have the labor, then you get tempted to do things such as spray herbicide around or get your bulldozer out and bulldoze it all away. But so many times I've seen people do this, when their land is covered with invasive plants. They'll bulldoze it all into a big pile, and then they'll think they're done with it, and within a year, the land will be covered with the same things that they tried to get rid of. And what do? Do they do it again? They just keep doing that until they're ready to bring in the labor, to plant the other things that they need to plant, to start taking care of the land, because that's what we're here for.
Particularly like with threats to native plants, you read about the damage that ungulates, you know, goats, pigs can do. But I mean, this garden seems, it seems like it's thriving. Is that a result of fencing?
Yes, for the most part. It's also partly where we are in the neighborhood. There aren't a lot of goats right around here. There are quite a lot of pigs, but we're kind of surrounded here by somewhat suburban development. And we haven't had pigs in here for a while. It can happen. And when and if they get in, they do tear up the ground. That can have its beneficial effects because you can throw seeds in the holes that they create, and you can use their damage as an opportunity to change up your mix of native, endemic, and Polynesian species. But if you have new seedlings in the ground or a garden, and they come in and dig around, they create a whole lot of damage.
Yeah, and I mean, we can hear the chickens, right? Those are around.
Yeah, those can also be a pain because if you're trying to plant seed especially, they'll come in and scratch it all up right away. Or if you have small, delicate plants you're trying to get established, you need to put a fence around them. You need to put a grill over them or something to keep the chickens from scratching them up. But they don't really do much to the larger plantings, and we kind of just live with them.
Yeah, learn to live with it. Anything else you'd like to add or you'd want listeners to know?
Well, just, you know, what we really need to do is figure out how to create a healthy and sort of symbiotic relationship with our landscape. And that's always going to be very specific to every place that you go and every site that you're working in. So don't always go for the harshest measures first. Sometimes if you have time and patience, it's a thing that can take many years to establish a landscape like this one.
Even just consider native landscaping.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Lou.
Thank you.
And we've also heard from the community about the role that invasive feral animals play in residents' everyday lives. Corey Grimes lives in Honoka'a. He spoke with Maddie Bender about his experience with feral goats and pigs.
Pigs are kind of a nuisance to in the backyard when they dig big holes and they, you know, eat up everything they can find. But it's their island, so you can't get too mad at them. You see goats all the time driving down to Kona on the side of the road. And I've never had a problem with them, but you know, I've seen some dead ones on the side and people, you know, hit them some time to time. Same with the pigs.
What do you do, like, or what do your neighbors do about pigs when they're in your backyard?
I used to have a pellet gun. I used to go outside and try to scare them off. But they can come by, like, you know, I think one time I saw about 8 or 9 in the backyard and kind of had to creep away because I felt like I could be overtaken by them, you know. And they'll just run against the fence, it's like full speed ahead, just try to break anything that they, you know, can find. Normally you just have to reinforce your fence because they'll keep going on the side of it, sort of like push it from night after night until finally they find some way to break through, and then they'll all get in and they'll come in and eat the mac nuts or avocados or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do they want?
they want the mac nuts, avocados, any sort of fruit. But if they can't find that, they'll just dig huge holes in your yard and look for grub worms and stuff like that. And just leave it a terrible mess.
Oh, gosh. Do you have, like dogs or kids or anything like that that you don't want the pigs getting to?
I have a dog. He'll bark at him if he sees them. I had a neighbor once who found the pigs were eating his baby goat. And I had never heard of that before, that they will actually eat a baby goat, like if they find one. They, you know, so that was kind of weird to hear. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is like the damage to the fence in the yard that they'll cause. Yeah.
We've been hearing about feral animals from Hawaii Island residents. There's some momentum to address the problems. The Department of Land and Natural Resources prepared a report for state lawmakers last legislative session requesting a task force to develop a management plan for feral ungulates in West Hawaii. And when we spoke to Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda last month, he shared with us that the county is considering new ways to address the issue of feral animals on roadways. One idea, an AI-powered light that flashes when feral game crosses the road to alert drivers of their presence. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. And this week's Mono Minute features a bird found on Maui, Molokai, and Hawaii Island. Meet the amakihi. Here's your Mono Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo biologist Patrick Hart.
The amakihi is a small yellow-green Hawaiian honeycreeper that's actually made up of three different species. The Hawaii amakihi from Hawaii and Maui Islands, the Oahu amakihi, and the Kauai amakihi. The Hawaii species is the smallest and brightest and has the shortest bill, while the one from Kauai is a bit larger, duller, and with the longest curved bill. Males of all three species have a black mask and are generally much yellower than the females, which are more gray-green. The song, which is similar across the islands and only sung by the male, is a series of repeated notes known as a trill, and sounds a lot like an old sewing machine. Both sexes do a short and distinctive call to keep track of each other that sounds a bit like gear. You can find these little birds foraging for nectar, fruit, and insects, mostly in ohia trees, but in lots of other trees as well. Perhaps more than any Hawaiian honeycreeper, they become a symbol of resilience against avian malaria, which is transmitted by non-native mosquitoes that bite them at night while they sleep. On Hawaii, Maui Nui, and Oahu, they may be evolving tolerance to this disease, and their trill can even be heard in some low-elevation areas where mosquitoes and people live, like Lower Puna on the Big Island and Manoa Valley on Oahu. Unfortunately, Kauai amakihi may not have developed this resistance, and their populations are sharply declining as temperatures warm and mosquitoes move into their remaining high-elevation habitat on the Alakai Plateau. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, working to protect Hawaii's native wildlife through programs and projects such as its Kolea Count. Learn more about programs and volunteering at hiaudubon.org.
The Mono Minute was the big clue about our next guest. Patrick Hart drove from the east side to be with us in Waimea last Friday at the Kahilu Theater. Hart leads the Alohi Bioacoustics Lab, which stands for Listening Observatory for Hawaiian Ecosystems. Here's our conversation from that event with Patrick Hart.
So I don't know if people know the backstory about how Manu Minute got started at Hawaii Public Radio. You called us up and said, hey, yeah, what do you think of this idea?
It was during COVID, and I have a lab, and we study birdsong in our lab, and I thought that the radio is just a great way to connect people with the song of birds because you only hear them. And that's the way birds connect with each other, too, is just by sound more than sight. And so I just thought radio would be a good place to just introduce some of the songs, the amazing songs of our native birds, and also just talk about their conservation as well, and ecology.
Well, I was glad to hear this segment because I now know the bird that's outside on my tangerine tree.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow, that is really cool.
Yeah. So thank you for that. Yeah. And, you know, we've chatted in recent months, and you were talking about how you're using artificial intelligence, AI, to help you sort through the hundreds of hours of bird recordings in the forest that you've made.
Yeah. It's a new way. So a big problem in conservation is just knowing how many there are left and how are they doing over time. And so it turns out now that we have new ways. You can put out these automated recorders that are waterproof. You can put them out in the forest for months at a time. pick them up, take the sound cards, upload hundreds of recorders worth of data over months into the computer, and we've trained AI algorithms to be able to detect the song of every species, and you can count how many songs there is, and we have ways now of estimating based on the number of songs that they make, how many birds we have left, and then how they're doing over time in each location. So it's a new way of monitoring not just birds, but all kinds of animals around the world.
Yeah, our wonderful forest, the ecosystem that exists there. And, you know, we have chatted before. You were trying to introduce the cultural element in the Manu Minute. So talk about the Hui Manu project.
Hui Manu. So birdsong is one way that people can connect with birds. And Ahui Manu is a group of bird lovers that I'm part of, that I've been part of from the beginning. And it was formed really just a way to explore these long cultural connections that people in Hawaii have had with the birds that are just such an important part of the environment here. I mean, there were never any native mammals, reptiles, or amphibians, so we had birds in Hawaii, and so they're just really important. And Ahui Manu is just a way to reestablish lost connections, I think, in a new way between birds and the people of Hawaii. So part of it, you know, the group is led by Kekuhi Kealii Kanakaoli Ohaili Lani, and she's a kumu of, she's just a kumu hula in Hilo, and she is leading us to create this new oli for Hawaiian birds to better envision the birds moving forward in greater health and abundance, I would say. And so what it basically does is it has a verse or a pauku or a verse in the oli, and it pairs a Hawaiian bird that's not doing well with a creature from the ocean and also with a plant from the land. And the idea is that by pairing them together in this oli, they would move forward in better abundance. We can envision them moving forward by chanting this oli. So the oli is about 27 verses long now, 27 birds. And yeah, it's just been really fun to, we've presented the oli at various bird festivals. Maybe some folks here have seen it before. It's a lot of fun. And one thing it does is it highlights what the birds say in the first sentence of the oli. So like the verse for the Hawaiian petrel or the uwa'u, basically, you know, uwa'u, many Hawaiian birds are named after what they sound like. So the uwa'u or the Hawaiian petrel, it goes wa wa wa. And so part of the verse is, you know, it's the oli is actually modeled after the kumulipo. Kekuhi calls it kumulipo 2 for Hawaiian birds, nice. Which the kumulipo, you know, is the Hawaii creation chant. So this is kind of in one sense a creation chant, a new creation chant for Hawaiian birds. But anyways, for the uwa'u, the first line, it goes hanau ka uwa'u, and then that's, you know, the uwa'u is born, and then you say kani, or actually you say the what the bird says, so you go wa wa wa, and so you do this for every bird, for all 27 birds, so it gets to be quite a, it's a fun oli to do, and it gets to be quite a cacophony of birds, so... Like I would say hanau ka uwa'u, and if I was doing this in a group, the whole group would go uwa uwa uwa, you know. So uwa uwa uwa, yeah. You can. So yeah, I'll just do it one more time. Just okay. So I go hanau ka uwa'u.
Uwa uwa uwa.
Yeah, that's
there you
excellent.
Go.
And that sounds like a that sounds like an uwa'u colony actually.
Well, we have a little snippet of the oli.
Of Kekuhi doing the oli.
Yes.
Yeah, so the oli that I just talked about, this is the real version of it.
Let's take a listen.
O ta lele a nei au nā o ka kai a lalani o o noho noho a pa pa ka aina o Hawaii kua uli o hua lau ka mā kua puka kāna keiki he manu kai lele. Hanau ka uwa'u, uwa'u, uwa'u. Kia I e ke kohola noho I kai. Ola maulo I ka puki ave noho I uka. O ka uwa'u auna lele a pa'apahia.
When you are actually recording these, they're out in the forest, right, as you're creating the Oli?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes we do it over Zoom, too. Yeah.
Well, and I know as you put the monuments together, you know, one stream of audio that most folks hear at the beginning, we've got a little snippet of that, too. It's not just one bird.
Right.
It's the dawn chorus. Yeah. Okay, let's take a listen.
Yeah, so that was, you know, if you wake up in the forest at Hakalau, you're surrounded by the songs of native birds early in the morning, and that was about 8 different species singing right there, probably more than you'd see anywhere else in the state, and Hakalau is just, you know, about, 15 miles away. If you go up Mana Road that way, you can get to Hakalau Forest and hear that if you get there early enough in the morning.
All right, sure. Well, there you go. So. Yeah. Big Island folks, you have this in your backyard, so go check it out.
Exactly. Yeah.
But thank you so much, Patrick.
Of course.
It's been a pleasure meeting you in person and sharing your story with our listeners.
Thank you so much. Great being here.
That was Patrick Hart, biology professor at UH Hilo, who we can thank for the Mono Minute. And fun fact, he is one of the lucky owners of Dr. Brady Bergen's Fixed Donkeys. We'd like to thank our friends and loyal listeners on the island of Hawaii who made this show possible, including the staff at the Kahilu Theater, where we spent time last Friday evening, and mahalo to the staff at the Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden for use of their space. We hope to be in your neck of the woods soon, as we here at The Conversation like to go on the road out in our community. Email us and let us know why we should come to your neighborhood. Send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for us today. We hope you enjoyed our Aloha Friday show. We are on the road in Kona today, and we brought you segments from the Kahilu Theater that we taped before a live audience last week. Coming up next week, we talk bike safety, now more than ever. Call our Talk Back line. Leave us your comments, 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Mark Ladau. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up The Conversation